Welcome to the record here on KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman. I'm in today for Bill Radke. Thanks to all of you for joining us. Congress has approved the first major overhaul of the nation's tax code in decades, but it's not strictly about taxes. It's also about oil.
This, Mr. President, is what energy dominance is all about. So let's go.
That's Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski talking about a provision in this tax bill that requires the government to open the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge, ANWR, to oil and gas lease sales. Drilling in ANWR has been a subject of bitter controversy and legal struggle for years. For more, we turn to Bloomberg's Jennifer Deloey. She reports on energy and the environment. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi.
What does this mean for drilling in ANWR, this bill?
Well, it means that, you know, for the first time in four decades, really oil companies may get the chance to pick up these leases and to eventually drill there. But there's quite a lot of steps that have to take place even after this tax bill is signed to make sure that happens. And it really could be a decade away.
I thought that they were required to open ANWR to leasing. What are some of those steps that are in the way?
Right. Under the bill, they are, and under this law, they're going to be required to do a lease sale within 4 years. But they're also required, the federal government is required to do quite lengthy environmental analysis and even ask the public to weigh in before they even begin a sale. And at every milestone along the way to that lease sale and even eventually drilling, environmentalists can use litigation to challenge every step. There's oil companies that are going to be wanting to do some new seismic research to look at what's underground, what might actually be out there. That can be challenged. The lease sale itself can be challenged. The drilling permits can be challenged. What I expect here is quite a lot of litigation before we can ever see wells drilled.
You mentioned can be challenged. Do you expect that those challenges will be filed?
Absolutely. I mean, the main issue is that the challenges have to wait for some government action. It can't happen right away, and it probably wouldn't happen right away, but it would happen perhaps when the state or the federal government approves some opportunities to do seismic research and look at really the geology there, or, you know, when that lease sale is planned. I will say that, you know, a few years ago, the Bush administration tried to sold leases to drill in the Chukchi Sea, and it took 7 years of litigation before that lease sale was actually affirmed. So it can be quite a lengthy process.
So Jennifer Deloey, we're looking ahead, but let's walk back a few steps. It was a surprising development about ANWR, at least to some of us. President Trump himself said ANWR by itself would be a big bill. So how did this oil and gas lease provision get stuffed into a tax bill?
Two words, Lisa Murkowski, the senator from Alaska, you know, who has really been a champion of ANWR drilling from the beginning, made a concerted push to make this part of the tax bill. And the way Republicans did that and folded that into this bill is by saying that selling these oil leases in ANWR and in this section of ANWR would be a big revenue raiser, raising, you know, potentially $1 billion. So that's essentially the justification they used for wedging this into this broader tax bill. It's the irony being that, you know, this very controversial tax bill actually overshadowed the controversy of ANWR drilling, even though for 40 years, drilling in that area has been fought successfully in Congress.
As I understand it from articles that you have written, the fact that this was put into a tax bill meant that we're talking about a simple majority needed to okay the opening up of this protected refuge. Had it been separate, it would have required a supermajority?
It would have been subject to the normal filibuster rules, and it is far from clear. In fact, it's quite unlikely that the supporters of ANWR drilling would have been able to get to that 60-vote threshold if this were as a standalone bill.
This is a specific provision in the tax bill, but I understand that advocates of increased oil and gas drilling have talked about other places that they would like to see expansion. Would those other places, the Atlantic, perhaps near the Mexican border, would those yield potentially as much oil and gas as ANWR would?
Yeah, actually, they probably would. What you've got here is oil companies are really doing in the lower 48. They're doing a lot of shale drilling, but that kind of those wells generally are short production. You might see oil production for a few months. What you see in the Gulf of Mexico, potentially in the Atlantic and even Arctic waters, as well as Anwar potentially, is the potential for a monster discovery. The kind of oil production that lasts for decades. It's expensive to get to that point, but the payoff can last for a long, long time, just as, you see BP and ConocoPhillips, engaged in the North Slope of Alaska and for decades already yielding oil from wells up there.
How cost effective is it to drill in Anwar as opposed to more accessible regions?
I mean, it's a remote territory. There aren't a ton of pipelines and other facilities, certainly near Anwar and other parts of the Alaska North Slope. There is infrastructure to support this. But that the remoteness of the area, the difficult conditions, the weather, all of that combined to make it really expensive to drill there. And we've heard estimates that oil prices would have to be another $15 per barrel at least to justify the exercise. Of course, it's most expensive for the first comers after that infrastructure is built up. To some degree, that lessens the cost for everybody else. But it's not a cheap place to work, and it is probably only attractive to a small set of oil companies.
Is there a big clamor to buy up these leases?
It's really uncertain. I don't sense a big clamor at all. There are analysts. Barclays came out with a note earlier this week saying that they thought oil companies that are already working in Alaska, so again, ConocoPhillips, BP perhaps, are more likely to take a look at Anwar and drill there or pursue leases anyway. But at the same time, there is a risk of operating in this area. It's potentially a PR nightmare. They point to the analysts point to the fact that Shell obviously got a lot of negative press for its efforts to drill in the Arctic Sea a few years ago, and some companies may just be wary of stepping into that themselves, even onshore in Alaska.
So this sounds like a big maybe. Why is Lisa Murkowski so excited?
Well, this is pretty firm in the law in the sense that it does the law now, or once President Trump signs this bill into law, will explicitly mandate lease sales. And this has been the holy grail for many Alaska politicians like Lisa Murkowski, like her father, even Ted Stevens, the former and deceased senator from Alaska. This is their holy grail. And now, for the first time in decades, it's actually codified in law. So they think, they can fight off these legal challenges, that it will eventually happen. And they'll get the oil that they have been crusading for, which is obviously important to the entire state.
Jennifer Deloy, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Marcy.
You're with The Record here on KUOW. The plutonium finishing plant in Richland, Washington, is just one of the highly contaminated radioactive sites on the Hanford Nuclear Reservation. The old factory used to make hockey puck-sized rounds for bombs during the Cold War. The radioactive material supposed to be contained, but something went very wrong this month. Anna King's been following this story. She's the Northwest News Network's Richland correspondent, and she explains how radioactive contamination got out.
They have this controlled area that's like fenced off and is very controlled, and somehow this material, this radioactive waste, got outside of the boundaries without detection, and then it got spread around. And so what's happened is basically a couple of workers came up with elevated levels of radioactive contamination, possibly in these little sipping lapel monitors. And then they had more findings of stuff like on trash cans and on jersey barriers and on vehicles. And then they had even more vehicles that came up with this contamination. Now it's this exhaustive search that they have tried to run down every bit of contamination outside of these boundaries. If you look at this map that they've created, it's just pin dotted with all of these yellow marks where they've found this contamination, dozens of marks across the map where they have just found this contamination in the last couple weeks.
And you're saying that could expand?
It could. I mean, they keep saying, okay, this is the last time we've got, you know, we've got this much contamination under here. And then they keep coming back with, oh yeah, now we've got some more cars, or now we're searching homes. And so the circle just keeps growing from what I can tell. And I think that we're all hoping that this is the last of it, but that's not for sure.
So, Anna, the six workers came in with these elevated lapel monitor levels. You were talking about them. What does that actually mean, this contamination?
Well, it could be as simple as just elevated radon, which is a naturally occurring source that, you know, sometimes can be increased by things like rainfall or a weather inversion like we had last week. But sometimes this could mean that there is actual, you know, plutonium or other daughter products of plutonium that are being picked up. And so they're just treating it as if everything is contamination right now until they can sort it all out. But these little machines that they wear on their clothing kind of sip the air all day long and filter it onto a little filter where they can take that at the end of the day and test it. And that's how these elevated readings came up. The fact that they have these levels isn't great. They might have been exposed to this stuff, and they are going to have to go through what they call a bioassay. That's basically a fecal sample in a high-tech lab, and it takes a couple weeks to get those initial tests back. More than 200 workers across the site have now requested those bioassay tests.
So they're worried about themselves as well. I'm talking with Anna King of the Northwest News Network about the latest potential contamination at Hanford. What do officials do after a contamination such as this is discovered?
Well, the first step is just not getting it in the first place. But, you know, if they can't do that, they have to nail this down. They can't allow this contamination to spread. And this was made worse, I should say, Marcy, by two things. First, the workers didn't notify their upper management at the time they should have. So there was a whole day and some hour lapse of time when people didn't know in the higher offices that this was going on. And then we had a wind event on last Sunday night that, you know, kind of moved some of this material around maybe. And so that's really made it a lot worse. And now they have, you know, these like 100, almost 200 workers that just aren't doing much out there right now. They're spraying fixative in areas that might have been contaminated. They're painting stuff to keep it in place. They just don't want this contamination to jump around anymore. And the Department of Health is doing the checks at people's homes, and these are really extensive checks. In fact, last night I interviewed the vice president of the contractor in charge of this demolition project for the plutonium finishing plant, and his name is Tom Bratfield. Here he is.
The house surveys are actually quite comprehensive, to the point of pulling furnace filters out of the furnace and checking those, checking floors, checking countertops, checking couches, chairs. And then as the owner of the home, right, we'll check any surface that they would like checked, but they are comprehensive surveys. They take hours.
Well, so, Anna, they're checking, they're spraying fixative, they're in people's homes. What happens if any of the workers exposed to this contamination actually ingest some radioactive material?
We're not sure exactly the steps that they'll be taking if that does happen. I've asked those questions to the Department of Energy and the contractor, and they tell me that they're going to get back to me. So watch my future coverage on this. But it's all to say that they take this extremely seriously. These tests are very rigorous. I have asked that they, you know, keep us informed on how these bioassays are coming back. That said, you know, there is a lot of sick workers out at Hanford. There's a lot of people who have been exposed to the metal beryllium in their lungs. There's a lot of people that have been exposed to chemicals from waste tanks and to radioactive waste. In fact, I've even been to the funeral of a Hanford worker that worked out at the tank farms and had kind of what you would call like a chronic wasting disease of his brain that he blamed on work at Hanford. So it is very serious, and these workers are exposed to a lot of hazardous stuff out here just because it is hazardous and it is a lot of waste out here.
Anna, listeners might remember this past spring there was a collapse in one of the tunnels, and a new report has called the ongoing Hanford cleanup one of the biggest challenges for the Department of Energy coming up in 2018. Let's just check in. How is cleanup at Hanford going right now?
Hanford right now has a lot of challenges. You know, every time you have like a work slowdown like this, it just sucks money off of the goal of cleanup. And you're just losing money and time. All of this money is from the same big pot. If they have a problem at Hanford, it's not like they get more money or that Congress usually, you know, adds into their budget. The only time that we've seen, you know, increases in the budget is under President Obama's stimulus package for the economy. And they get about $2 billion a year, and that spreads over the entire site. And it's like a huge city. It's 580 square miles of dirt. And that money keeps the roads working, the lights on, and things safe for workers out there. So if they're taking money away, trying to make things safer, that means that real cleanup doesn't get done because that money's coming from somewhere. You know, idling about 200 workers and demo experts isn't cheap. And if they're not doing demo, they're just losing time. And there's no time frame that they've given so far, the Department of Energy or the contractor, that says when they'll start this work back up. And all of this work is behind schedule. It was supposed to be complete of September of last year. And of course, these contamination incidents happened at the plutonium finishing plant. There are five more huge plants, Marcy, just like this, that have to be cleaned up. In fact, those plants are more robust construction and so will be more difficult to take down.
My gosh, a massive undertaking. So even if there was enough money, this isn't something that's going to happen very quickly in any case.
No. And in fact, this is just one of the contaminated sites on this massive Hanford nuclear reservation. We are also dealing with the 56 million gallons of radioactive waste in underground pots. You know, it's kind of stewing away in there. It's like the consistency of peanut butter and water and salt cake all mixed together. And it's a really technical problem. And the plant that they're building to treat that waste is also having very tough technical problems. And maybe the kicker is this, Marcy. CH2M Hill, the contractor in charge of this demolition site where all the escaped waste has just been, you know, moved around that we've been talking about this morning, that has been sold. That company has been sold to another company. So now this new company will have to step in and manage this whole situation.
Starting from scratch, in a sense. Anna King of Northwest News Network, thanks so much for all your reporting on this, and thank you so much for taking time to talk with us about it today.
You're very welcome.
This is The Record here on KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman in for Bill Radke today. Tomorrow is your very last chance to grab a turkey sandwich at Bakeman's Restaurant. The restaurant's packing it in after 47 years in downtown Seattle. It's not just Bakeman's. Belltown's Two Bells Tavern will close on New Year's Day. And man, those sausage sandwiches were so wonderful. Also, the Boren Avenue 13 coin set for closure. That place has been a classic late night spot for clubbers and partygoers. It's not a dive. It's just dependable food open into the wee hours. But A bright spot, 13 Coins will be reopening in Pioneer Square, so all is not lost. Things are always changing, but sometimes the loss of old favorite spots really does affect us. We wondered why and what is lost when favorite haunts go away. Those were questions writer and ethnographer Jamie Garbacik wanted to answer when she started a project about Seattle's disappearing places. It's called Ghosts of Seattle Past, and here she is talking with Jeannie Yandel earlier this year.
You're the title of the project, the title of the book, Ghosts of Seattle Past, and you might think these are about haunted places in Seattle. There are plenty of ghost stories in this town, but this is about places that no longer exist. Why did you decide to call those places that no longer exist ghosts?
Well, I think that comes down to the inspiration for the book in the first place, which in a lot of respects was the fact that I felt that people were mourning and didn't have a place to put that, didn't have a vehicle or a way to vent or process all of the change. And it did feel as though people were becoming a bit haunted by the places that they missed. And the ghosts for me are people's memories more than they are the places that are gone. But you can also say that the haunts, in air quotes, you know, the places that we all haunted, the gathering places that we spent time becoming the best versions of ourselves in, and the places that shaped the city and that shaped different communities, those haunts are our ghosts as well.
Well, initially, the project you had in mind was smaller in scope than yes. What it is now.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was a website, but it was also going to be an art exhibit and a zine. Mm-hmm. But what happened? What caused the scope of it to change?
The response to the call for submissions. We just had an avalanche, a veritable avalanche of stories come in. I mean, there were hundreds, and the parameters were really simple. The place had to be public. It had to be gone, and you had to have a personal memory of the space. It couldn't be like a historical thing that you felt was significant. You had to have had the memory yourself. It exploded.
You described the number of submissions you got as an avalanche. You put your hand over your heart as you were describing all of the submissions you got. What's a story that comes to mind that you got that you would have never expected to get?
Okay. Yeah, I've got one for you. So Janet Schurel sent me a note about her brother, Fritz, who had drowned in a bog in West Seattle when he was a kid, when they were very young. And I was confused at first about how this was a lost place for her. I mean, it was clearly a very compelling and very sad story, but I wasn't sure what she meant for me to be marking or preserving as the space that had been lost. And what it turned out that bog had been a gardening space for a lot of Japanese families that produced food for Pike Place Market. But during the internment, they all were taken. And when they were, that arable land became a bog and children drowned in it. Yeah. I had never heard anything about that before. There's been very little reportage on it, honestly. But what that did for me was to completely resituate the way I thought about our interconnectivity in the city. Because when we think about the internment, it's clearly, specifically, a tragedy for the Japanese community and for the international community. But it's not, you know? I mean, their disappearance has a profound effect on everyone around them as well. And I guess I just felt like that story really made a very visual metaphor of the way that we are never on our own in a city. We're never isolated. We're never able to escape and shouldn't try to escape the way that we are codependent and that we are reliant on everyone around us to make
a safe and vibrant landscape, and those sorts of tragedies have ripple effects you'd never see coming.
That's an amazing story. I'm talking with Jamie Garbacek. She's the creator of the anthology Ghosts of Seattle Past. It's also an interactive art exhibit. And I have to say, though, it feels like when we talk about change, particularly in Seattle, where it happens so rapidly, we always assume that there's loss, that there's heartbreak associated with it. I mean, I looked at three news stories yesterday about change and development in Seattle, and I'll read you the headlines. Two are from the Seattle Times. Upzoning has some Belltown residents worried. Mm-hmm. Row House Cafe, a South Lake Union holdout to be torn down for apartments, and then a third one from Crosscut. Poor gargoyles. We're smashing Seattle's history as we build. I mean, does change always have to bring this sense of loss?
I think change is inevitable and often good and healthy. I'm pro-density. I think there's an easy assumption to make that this is some kind of NIMBY project, and the truth is it couldn't be further from that. I mean, I am from the East Coast, and I'm used to dense cities, and I think that that can be a really healthy environment for thriving art and diversity. The difference is the way that we're developing here and the rapidity of it, and whether or not that process is inclusive. And so, yes, I do think that there's always going to be loss, but I don't think that that needs to have the collateral damage of so much forgetting. There hasn't been as much effort to preserve culturally significant spaces here in some respects as many other cities. And again, I'm not anti-development, but I want to see it be an inclusive process that has demographically diverse conversations involved. I don't want as much cultural erasure as has been prevalent in Seattle's history. I mean, we have a very long history of erasing what came before in order to capitalize on innovation in the moment. And I think that if we want to be this world-class city that we all sit around dreaming about, that to do that, it needs to be an inclusive process, and we need to be really cautious that we don't price out all artists and people of color and queer people, because it's going to become a really homogenous, very white, very rich city with a lot less to recommend it if we are not more careful about that.
It does make me wonder, though, the portrait you are painting of Seattle's future doesn't sound very exciting. And it doesn't sound very welcoming. Do you have any optimism for Seattle's future?
I'll be honest, I'm definitely afraid for Seattle right now. San Francisco's dead. It's over. It's still a beautiful city, but it doesn't have the same heartbeat that it had 20 years ago. And I don't want to see that happen here. I don't think that it's inevitable, but I think that there's a real danger of it becoming frighteningly the same, you know, a very repetitious landscape. And I don't mean just condos. I mean the kind of people who can afford to be here and the kind of businesses and projects that can afford to be here, the kind of art that can afford to thrive here. And so I think it's possible that it can continue to be wonderful, but I think we're at a really dangerous tipping point right now where it could kind of go either way. And what I wanted for this project was two things, was for people to have a way to process this change and grief and to commemorate the places that they loved, and for that to, you know, to be something that people can hold in their hands and to give it back to them. And at the same time, it was to hopefully inform the city and developers and city officials and people who are making some of the choices about what is going to happen in the city going forward, about what mattered most and what was most significant to people at a certain moment in time.
So beyond remembering what places that are gone might have meant to me. Mm-hmm. What would you have me do? How can we contribute to this vision that you're talking about for what Seattle could be?
Show up. Show up to your community's events and picnics and theater productions. Not everyone can show up to like a city planning meeting. You know, you might not have childcare, you might be working three jobs. Like, there's a barrier to entry to being involved in the process of being part of the planning. But you can help to make sure that more diverse voices are heard if you are in dialogue with your neighbors. You know, when we were gathering stories, a lot of it wasn't just what came into us. You know, I was going out and interviewing people, but we were going to, say, like the Roots family picnic at Gasworks. You know, we would show up to that because I lived in the Central District and I knew a lot of the people there, and we would ask them about places they miss, and some of the things that would come up isn't necessarily what you'd anticipate. I mean, I expect to hear about the old jazz venues that are gone, but I didn't expect to hear about the lack of a specific hardware store that had been a very important cultural service, in the sense that the owner would go right to people's houses and help them make repairs, and they had specialized knowledge and they were willing to give things on credit to people they knew. And that was a huge leg up for a lot of families in economic distress. These sorts of things weren't even on, I mean, if I'm honest, weren't even on my radar as being the biggest concerns. But once you start showing up for your community in that way, once you know that, it's so much easier to make sure that there is representation and to make sure that their concerns are included in the decision making of the city. You know, don't live in your little bubble in this city in the future. Get outside your comfort zone and interact with as many people as are in this city, or else pretty soon it's just going to be you and people just like you here.
Some good advice from Jamie Garbacik. She spoke with Jeannie Yandel on the Record. Here with The Record on KUOW Seattle and KUOW.org. I'm Marcy Silman. Bill Radke's off. You can also find us on Twitter at KUOW and on Facebook. We're KUOW Public Radio. Today, December 21st, one of my favorite days of the year. It's the winter solstice. Officially, the solstice took place at 8:28 this morning, so that means it's now winter. But the solstice also means that every day from now until June, we'll see a little bit more daylight. For some of us, a few seconds more light tomorrow may not be enough to stave off the winter blues or worse, seasonal affective disorder. We're going to talk about what you can do to beat those blues. But first up, Scott Sistek joins us. Scott's a meteorologist at Como News. He also calls himself the spokesperson for Seattle's rain fans. Scott, welcome to The Record.
Thanks, Marcy. Appreciate it.
You're the spokesperson for the rain fans. What's there to love about the rain here?
You know, I grew up around here, and actually, my dad was in the Coast Guard. I spent a lot of years over on the coast, so both the Washington and Oregon coast. And as much as it's cloudy in Seattle, it's even cloudier over there. And so I just kind of grew up used to it being kind of foggy almost, you know, 3 days out of four. And I just grew to like it. And I've had to live on the East Coast for a few years when I was a child, and I really didn't like the heat and humidity. And I've just come to love. It's like, okay, well, I'm just not a heat fan. I like it when it's cold and rainy. So I know there's a lot of other people around here that feel the same way. So I've kind of anointed myself the spokesperson for the quiet minority.
And the best thing about the rain?
You know, I love the sound. I love the feel, and like how it kind of makes the air a little bit cooler. And I love how it keeps the air so clean.
Clean is a good thing. Should we expect a lot of rain this year?
So we are thinking yes. You've probably heard this term batted around, La Nina, and it kind of goes with El Nino. It's a 3 to 7 year cycle of overall weather patterns. And when we're in a La Nina winter, as we are this winter, more times than not, it leads to a wetter and cooler winter. Most of the time we kind of focus with La Nina years, it means that there'll be a lot of snow in the mountains, which is good. So we're We're thinking it'll be great, you know, pretty good ski season coming up here. We think our water supply should be good for the summer if this keeps going. For those of us here in the lowlands, it usually does mean, you know, a little bit grayer than even a normal winter and a little rainier than a normal winter. But for the snow fans, it also means that we usually have a few extra days of snow around here than a normal winter as well.
Down here in the lowlands, you mean?
Yes. Yeah,
oh,
down here.
All right. Something to think about. You mentioned La Nina. Over the past couple of years, we've been hearing some new weather words in addition to the blob coined over here at the University of Washington.
That was my favorite ones, yeah.
Yeah, but I heard one, bombogenesis. What is that?
That's been around for a while, and it's kind of a rare term, and it's used for when a storm system forms really rapidly. Because we talk about a lot of our windstorms around here happen when a storm, maybe even just, you know, as much as a day and a half or 2 days out, is not that strong, but it will go under intense strengthening over a very short period of time. And so we've always called that, it's kind of like bombing out.
Oh, I see.
And so the process of that happening is bombogenesis. And
bombogenesis.
It's one of the great band names that hasn't been used yet.
I may appropriate it. What other terms do you like?
Well, there was one we were trying, and I haven't been very successful. Maybe it'll start today, because starting off December, when we had just this endless, like, dry, a week and a half of dry weather, which is nearly unheard of.
Yep.
And it's caused by a ridge of high pressure. You heard us talk about that a lot.
Yep.
And this was a really big ridge, so I was trying to go with mega ridge. And we were joking about it on Twitter, and I asked the Weather Service, I said, do we really have an official name for this? And they wrote back, and they said, well, you can call it whatever you want. It's okay. And so I said, well, then I'm going to start calling it Ridgy McRidgeface.
That's good. So from now on, when we get a big surge of dry, clear weather in the winter, it's going to be a Ridgy McRidgeface?
Ridgy McRidgeface. I'm going to try and trademark it.
Okay. I'm talking with Como meteorologist Scott Sistek. Well, Scott, you mentioned snow. What kind of weather can we expect for the holiday weekend?
Boy, you know, it's funny you should ask, because going into this week, we thought Ridgy McRidgeface was going to make a second appearance, and it was going to be a pretty long dry period. And in the last, like, 24 to 36 hours, everything's kind of changed. And now it looks like we may have a weather system somewhere in the neighborhood here on Christmas Eve or Christmas Day.
My.
And we're still trying to figure it out. Our forecast charts are kind of all over the place on it. And, you know, it's chilly out there, too. So, you know, aside from will there be, you know, rainfall or moisture, now we got to start thinking about, well, you know, would it be cold enough that maybe it starts to snow in some places?
Oh, my.
So, yeah, so that's kind of the question of the day here is, you know, Christmas up until about 2 days ago was looking blazingly sunny like it was yesterday. And now we're all kind of like, uh-oh, things may be changing here.
We're dreaming of that white Christmas. Well, just one last thing. You, the advocate for all things gray, what's your advice for people who are worried about how to survive winter in the Northwest?
Boy, for me, it's just, and obviously as someone who likes the gray, it's hard for me to relate. But, you know, the best example I have is it's hard to drive somewhere in the winter to find sunshine. You can try Eastern Washington. There are some days it's sunny over there. A lot of days it's foggy. And so the only thing I can think of, I know it's not easy, is, you know, sunshine is not too long of a plane flight away. You know, I know a lot of people go to Hawaii. I know a lot of people go to Central and Southern California or Arizona. That's probably the best way to do it. I know, like, some people use light boxes and
yep.
try open windows and that sort of thing as well. But
learn to ski.
Learn to ski, yeah, go up to the mountains. It's brighter up there. The snow, you know, any kind of sun you get reflecting off the snow will make it for brighter than down here.
All right, or just learn to love where you are.
It's not bad being a rain fan, I can attest from years of experience.
Scott Sistek, chief rain fan and meteorologist for Como News. He's author of the blog Partly to Mostly Blog, and thanks so much for being with us.
Sure, thanks for having me.
Well, today is the shortest day of the year, and here in Seattle we're talking with folks all about the winter blues. Dr. David Avery is a psychiatrist and professor emeritus at the University of Washington. Earlier today, I asked him to explain how our bodies actually respond to the solstice and the darkness.
During the solstice, the sunrise is very late, the sunset is very early, and our circadian rhythms respond to those signals. When we fly to the East Coast, we are trying to wake up at 8 a.m. on the East Coast, and that's actually 5 a.m. body clock time. Our body clock hasn't shifted yet. That lack of morning light at this time of year creates the clockwise shift in our rhythms. so that we're trying to wake up in the middle of our biological night. Our bodies are not ready to wake up until the sun rises. And yet we're trying to wake up, well, this time of year, 2-3 hours before the sun actually comes up.
And I'm sure, Dr. David Avery, that all of our listeners at this point are saying, no wonder I'm so tired right now. We're speaking on the winter solstice about seasonal affective disorder, or maybe less mild versions. What happens to us when we don't see much daylight? We are very far to the north. Is seasonal depression different in Seattle than other places around the country or the world?
Yes, there are epidemiologic studies indicating that the seasonal affective disorder does increase with latitude, about 1% in Florida, about 10% in Vermont, also Alaska, and also probably Seattle. In addition, anecdotally, I can say that I have a lot of patients who have moved from the Midwest or East Coast, similar latitude, but our cloud cover plays a significant role, I believe. There they had the bright sunny days, sun reflecting off the snow, and they come to Seattle and have this much greater cloud cover.
Well, what's something that we can do here that might surprise people who are listening or reading online?
Well, I don't know if it's a surprise, but the bright light therapy and dawn stimulation have been found to be very helpful for relieving the symptoms of winter depression. The bright light box is simply a box that one can sit in front of in the morning soon after awakening. The dawn simulator is a gradually increasing luminance in the bedroom, and these have both been found to be helpful in relieving the symptoms of winter depression compared to control conditions.
Dr. Avery, you mentioned our cloud cover. Does it help to go outside in winter daylight even if it is cloudy?
Yeah, even cloudy days are much, much brighter than being indoors. On average, being outside on a cloudy day is about 10 times brighter than being indoors.
So we should get outside every day.
We should get outside, yeah.
So if you were going to tell somebody to the most important thing to do, just one thing, what would it be?
Expanding the photoperiod. Expanding the period from sunrise to sunset. Add more light in the morning and add more light in the early evening.
You're not telling me to fly to Hawaii, are you?
If you wish. But I think there are ways of dealing with this without traveling to sunny climates. The light therapies are very effective. Many people simply use the bright light therapy or dawn stimulation during the weekdays. And all the scientific studies of these two devices have had their subjects use the bright light and dawn stimulation even on weekends. Having a regular light-dark cycle is very, very important. And I realize that society in general likes to stay up late on Friday, Saturday nights, sleeping on Saturday and Sunday mornings, but that's very unnatural. I mean, that's creating a kind of jet lag. It's kind of analogous to flying to Honolulu on Friday night and then trying to fly back to Seattle on Sunday evening. And that jarring of the circadian rhythms is, well, analogous to jet lag. It's been dubbed social jet lag.
So maintain a regular schedule is what you're saying.
Maintain a regular schedule, keep the light-dark cycle regular, and also make sure that photoperiod doesn't become too short. I mean, at this time of year, the photoperiod is approximately 8 hours and 25 minutes today, and that's not much.
No, it isn't. Well, dawn simulator, bright light, both of those sound good. I wish you joy as the light returns to us, daylight returns to us. Dr. David Avery, thanks so much for your time.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so you're ready for a wet winter. You've got your bright lights at home. What if you want to go outside? Anna Sophia Knauf is from the Evergrey, and she is here to walk us through Seattle in winter. And I see, Anna Sophia Knauf, that you've actually escaped Seattle in winter. You're talking to us from L.A.?
Yep, I'm talking to you from Santa Monica, California.
Okay, where it's probably sunny.
Quite. I did bring some Seattle weather with me yesterday. It was pretty gray and a bit chilly for LA.
I hope it was raining there too. Well, back to Seattle. What are hidden gems that you would advise people to seek out in this dark time?
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of warm spots across the city that are especially cozy when it's this chilly and gray and gross outside. One of my favorite places to go is the Volunteer Park Conservatory.
Mm.
It's for anyone who's not super outdoorsy, this is a great place to go to get a taste of nature. Even when it's gross outside, you can't quite make it to a hike and you need to go somewhere during the week. There's their cactus room, which is always kept super toasty, and there's lots of sunlight when there's some outside that floods in through the glass windows, and it's really beautiful. There's cacti like towering over you. It's just a really cool, almost alien-like feeling, especially in the middle of Seattle's winter. But I love going there and being able to surround myself by plants. I'm a big plant nerd, so that's always exciting to me.
What other places do you think are particularly cool this time of year, or warm, I guess I should say?
Yeah, one of those places, I really love the fire pits outside of the Perihelion Brewery over in Beacon Hill, really close to light rail for anyone who wants to take transit there. It's a cozy little brewery. They have like a pretty great happy hour, lots of little bites, and then their outdoor fire pit is super warm. They have nice blankets and like Adirondack chairs for you to cozy up into. And they usually have live bluegrass that's happening. And I think that that's just like a fun way to kind of be outside, but still kind of be nice and toasty like you would be inside with your heater on.
I see one other place that you recommend is the Butterfly House at the Pacific Science Center.
Yes, I'm a little biased, so I used to work at the Pacific Science Center, but the Butterfly House, every time I've taken my nieces there, they've absolutely loved it. It's really like balmy, kind of humid in there, which makes sense. And then there's like these cool moths and like really gorgeous butterflies that are just kind of flitting around the room. It's just a really interesting place to like go and learn something, also see something kind of cool, while also pretending that you're, I don't know, maybe in the rainforest or in Florida at the very least.
I have done that very thing. I'm talking with Ana Sofia Canal from the Evergrey. And what have you not yet checked out that you're excited about?
So I actually heard that some of our local pools are pretty great. Surprisingly, I've never actually been to one of our like local community pools, and I would love to go. I don't think I've done any pool swimming here.
they are exceptional, I must say. I'm a regular attendee at Meadowbrook Pool in Northeast Seattle.
Oh,
so
nice.
Do check it out. You aren't originally from here. I assume from LA, maybe?
Yep, I am from Northern Los Angeles.
So what was it like when you first came here?
So I moved to Seattle for college to go to the University of Washington, actually. And my first winter here, as I learned, was between November and March, which was surprising to me. It was kind of rough. You're starting college, you're in a new place, trying to adjust to things. But I really felt like November and February especially both really weighed on me, like mentally. Mm. It just felt like the life had been sucked out of me at some point. But I mean, thankfully, I had a really great support system of my college friends. And then we also did a lot of outdoor stuff that just honestly I had to grin and bear the cold outside. But just being immersed in like the outdoors, I think, with the right clothing, granted, good boots, nice warm jacket, really helped break me out of that.
Well, I'm sure you've seen the same statistics that everybody else has seen, that we've got, you know, a zillion newcomers flooding into our community every month, pretty much. So what advice do you have for them to adapt themselves to a winter in Seattle, or at least a first winter in Seattle?
Yeah, well, besides subscribing to the Evergrey, obviously, as we think about all the cool events that are happening out in the city, I think it's really just half of the battle of winter is forcing yourself to go outside into it. And I think that especially as a newcomer, you really have to try to do that, whether it's just like finding your neighborhood coffee shop that's especially like warm, where you can just like go to read or do a little bit of work if you need to. I think finding your neighborhood coffee shop is like a great first step to doing that. And then if you like want to treat yourself, go take yourself to somewhere nice. Like I know that in downtown, especially for any of the Amazonians or Microsofties who are down there, I think there's the Banya 5 spa, and I've heard amazing things about just the pools, the steam rooms, and that sounds like a great way to like treat yourself and like give yourself a pat on the back for staying through the winter so far. And it's also just, I think you really have to learn to embrace the winter, because I think it's honestly what, like, having lived in Seattle now for just over 7 years, winter can be a really great time of year. It's like, it's really beautiful outside, like with lights, with nature. I think you see everything that's green outside pop even more than it usually does. I think it's gorgeous personally.
Yep. Yep. You have to just embrace it, don't you?
You do. I think so. I think you learn to love it. It might take a little while, but I feel like people will learn to love it.
Well, Anna Sophia Knuff of the Evergrey, thank you for joining us. Thanks for those words of encouragement, and have a happy holiday season.
Thank you. Thanks, Marcy.
We got a lot of input on our social media about how to cope with winter, and producer Amina Alsadi is here to tell us what some people were saying.
Hey, Marcy. Yeah, so we got a lot of great advice. Listener Sarah wrote in, and she said, embrace it 100%. Hiking through the wet green moss-covered trees, walking on bitter cold beaches, smelling of salt, while the wind cuts through your jacket, standing in a frigid ray of sunshine poking through a forest canopy. This is the Northwest. It's cold and wonderful in the winter, and once you let it become part of you, you crave it.
And get a warm coat while you're letting all that cut through you.
Exactly, exactly.
Well, that is the most beautiful advice that we can leave you with on this, the very first day of winter, the winter solstice. Thanks for listening to The Record. The show is put together by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jima Brempong, Bond Huberman, and Jason Pagano. I'm Marcy Silman. I'm in for Bill Radke. Thanks for listening. And again, happy solstice.